I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
Great to be here as always, Michael.
Well, one thing's for sure, there's never a shortage of things to talk about. Martin, when I travel, a constant companion of mine has become the Australian government's smart traveller. There's both the website and the daily emails I get. In fact, I don't need to read newspapers anymore to know what's going on geopolitically, because it tells me there's something happening in Bhutan and they're ratcheting up the anti-smoking laws in Singapore, and look out if you go to Guatemala, and Morocco's not safe in places at the moment. But yesterday, not entirely surprisingly, this arrived, the advice, and I read it. The situation in the Middle East is unpredictable. It could get worse with little warning. Security risks may increase. There may be travel disruptions within the region and globally. Make sure your travel insurance covers you. Shouldn't laugh, but we all have probably been caught up one way or the other. But Martin, what's behind all of this? Has it got something to do with President Trump?
It absolutely does. So he has issued a series of ultimatums to the rulers of Iran, and they're big pieces, and the pieces they almost certainly won't acquiesce in, such as abandoning their nuclear program, downsizing their missile stockpile, and get this, stop funding Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. Now, I just can't see this happening. And having issued that deadline, what comes next? We all know about the TARCO. You know, Trump always chickens out, but he is keen to show that he doesn't always chicken out. So we are on the precipice of perhaps something extraordinary there. And this could fast become the biggest story of the week, the month, the year. So if there is another broader, more widespread series of strikes on Iran, this time not just targeting nuclear facilities, but this time perhaps targeting the military or political leadership of Iran, things could get quite messy. We know that there's a backdrop of a whole range of protests, widespread protests in Iran, because of the internet blackout. We don't know how many people have been killed in those protests. There's a very unstable situation happening there, and it's a country of almost 100 million people.
Martin, if you just read a range of international and national media on this question of Iran being targeted by the US, by Trump, you get the sense that this is really real. I mean, even the New Yorker magazine, which deals with all sorts of interesting topics, has a lead piece today about what's happening. There seems to be very accurate figures about the number of people who have been quote unquote massacred. The talk about snipers have been in the buildings taking out innocent civilians in that sense, protesting recently. We've got numbers from hospitals which are dealing with the injured or the killed, which seem to be quite accurate. And we're told there are these real divisions in Iranian society. You get the impression that the US thinks this is a timely moment to strike in one of the ways that you suggest. But Iran also said that they'll come back and in Trumpian type language, you'll get more than you ever bargained for.
This is where it could get really messy, because, and we had all this before, if you recall, last year when there were some very limited strikes on their nuclear facilities. There's a whole range of US assets in the region which are perhaps susceptible in Iraq and other places to attacks. So Iran's response to those strikes last year were fairly muted. I don't think they wanted a big conflagration. But if their backs are to the wall and they feel that this is existential, they may well think, what the heck? And this could get very messy very quickly. I don't want to over-egg this, but you know, there's potential there for a bigger conflict.
Well, you go back to what the Australian government have told us all. If we're travelling in this area, the situation in the Middle East is unpredictable. Martin, it does appear that this is sufficiently serious for people not only to say they're prepared to talk, but things are happening in Ankara. I think there's high-level meetings between the US diplomats or political leaders and the Iranian diplomats or leaders. And it's interesting that Turkey comes into to this picture. I mean, is there any hope? I suppose there is some. If they get together, what will they talk about? And secondly, does Iran have some real friends who will, in a NATO sense, come in behind them if they're struck by big-time American missiles?
Not a lot. They do have a good relationship with Russia. I don't think Russia's inclined to probably get on the front foot and join in any conflict against the US. They have some relationship with China as well, other contacts as well, but they're not part of a broader military alliance that would take on the US. It's more just that they have a lot of proxies across the Middle East. That they've been funding for some time and directing for some time. And it's more around the sort of guerrilla style tactics, Michael, rather than the conventional conflict that they would be seeking to pursue, I'd expect. And this would be random attacks on US forces across the area. There's some talk that Iran has agents in Western countries, and that's a possibility as well. You would think that US security services would be well and truly on top of that, but there's a lot of unknowns here.
That's a frightening thought that sleepers, agents in unpredictable places, some of the leading cities in Western Europe, for example, without notice, something happens just to say or show that we Iran can do things, so pull back. I mean, how much notice does a study of international relations tell us that countries give before they actually enter into a conflagration like seems to be threatened here?
Essentially, it's a risk assessment. So Iran at the last time assessed that a war with the US would be existential to their existence. Sorry, that's a bad use of grammar, but I think you know what I mean. They would be wiped out. Whereas they countered that a token pushback would preserve their regime. This time round, if they're already teetering and already facing a lot of domestic challenges, that risk assessment might be different. And that's what this is all about. That doesn't apply for the US in the same way. Obviously, it's an asymmetric conflict. The US is much more powerful than Iran. But there are certainly risks. And there's risks. It's much easier to get into a war, Michael, than there is to get out of it. So I think that would be playing on a few decision makers in Washington.
I imagine, like I see people down at the dog beach in South Fremantle, holding the leash tightly so their big Doberman doesn't knock me over on my bike. The US would have to have a strong leash on Israel, wouldn't they? That Israel doesn't rush off and do something silly.
I think this is a bit of a wild card here. As much as there is a lot of domestic opposition to the Iranian regime from within it, I think the involvement of Israel would be unhelpful in this stage. And the US would be keen to keep Israel out of this because I think that would probably feed into the Iranian regime's propaganda that this is all about Israel. Israeli agents stirring up things. I think there are a genuine uprising there in Iran, and it's not just down to Israel or the US. A lot of people are very ha unhappy and want to see change. But it suits, of course, the regime to paint this all as a foreign agents issue.
Martin is a long-time Dockers supporter. I and many others still recall what was called the Mother's Day massacre, when before the first bounce, one of our players seemed to, in a chain reaction sort of way, started a mighty brawl. I think he got some weeks for it later. And the supporters in, or maybe it's just the male supporters, maybe it's just me in some strange, perverse way, you sort of look back and think, gosh, that was all terribly interesting. You know, it's against the rules. You don't want to see it happen. And it's a bit the same here. I mean, you don't want to see this happen, but wars do break out. I mean, how do you stop the war happening here? I mean, it really is quite serious.
It is really, this is a great dilemma. You've got a regime that is quite oppressive on its own people and an uprising within. You've got a foreign entity like the US that is involved sometimes for its own reasons. On the one hand, I don't think anyone would have any, not many people would have that much sympathy for the Iranian regime. But at the same time, civil war is a really brutal concept, and a power vacuum in Iran presents other problems as well. It could actually increase terrorist activity in other parts of the world. There's a lot of unknowns here that we should be very wary about. Revolutions are very rarely peaceful, pleasant processes.
And that is why, quite seriously, I take my hat off to people who are now in our government who act sanely and sensibly, that you've got thoughtful ministers, but you've also got this wonderful bureaucracy of experienced and informed people behind them. You just have to hope that everybody does the right thing and we come through the pipeline and out the other side without disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our government will be walking very tight, right, very tight, tightrope, tightrope. On, yeah, tongue twisted today, Michael. Around expressing, some degree of sympathy for the protests, but at the same time not inflaming things and not wanting to put at risk Australian citizens and not wanting to involve itself in the conflict directly.
Martin, we'll come back probably next week when there's greater clarity to Ukraine and Russia. But it seems that things are not exactly in a state of truce, but in a state of flux at the moment. Do you think some good news might come out shortly?
Oh, we're hearing more conversations and more discussions around those two things, around land and around security guarantees. It's a bit hard because we've had so many so-called green shoots arise here, Michael, for so long. Every time you hear another word of optimism, it's a bit hard to know how much stock to place on it. So we're hearing again some periodic comments from US officials that some kind of settlement's not far away. But I'm getting a bit more skeptical because of so many other false starts, Michael. But you never know.
Well, we don't talk much either at the moment. We've reflected in passing on what's happening with the 20-point peace plan, Israel-Gaza. But we are going to hear a lot of words in Australia next month when the Israeli President Isaac Herzog comes. It's been confirmed by Prime Minister Anthony Albanese that he is coming. And a number of groups, some of them Jewish groups in Australia, are protesting very loudly. What do you think we can expect? There'll be public demonstrations. They're not going to close them down, are they?
No, and we've talked about this topic a few times. There has to be capacity for people to protest, particularly hold a foreign government to account. And at the same time, if there are certain things that cross over that pathway into hate speech, and anti-Semitism, like any other forms of racism, we work against that. So trying to find that balance is going to be important. And this will be a flashpoint. We're talking about the president of Israel here. The president of Israel is not like the president of the United States. It's more of a ceremonial role than the prime minister holds the real power there. But it's still the head of state effectively coming and visiting. So I certainly expect to see protests, and I certainly expect to see tension again, perhaps reaching flashpoint over this issue.
Well, we'll be reporting on that and commenting on that when it all happens a little while to go yet, Martin. But on the national scene here, the Susan Lee, David Little, proud sort of not quite matching caravans continues on. The men on the right have been meeting. A lot of criticism of how they met and when they met. And for the moment, everyone's saying Susan Lee seems to be in her job, but do you think it is just a matter of time?
I think it is a matter of time. I think it's not a case of if, it's a case of when. And it's a case that there's just a couple of things. Firstly, they're looking for the right timing. And that's probably going to take place around the parliamentary sitting week. I think that's usual. Further to that, it's the case of there being two main challenges, both from the same faction. So I would expect that once they work that side of things out, then a challenge is much more imminent. You're talking Andrew Hastie and Angus Taylor. I think they both have aspirations. if they both run, then they probably Susan Ley would have more than each of them. So there's a little bit of resolution there for them to work out, but I think Susan Ley's days are numbered.
So, I mean, without sort of asking an obvious answer to an obvious question, what has she done wrong? Why would you dump her?
There's a number of things, and I think that I have some empathy for her as well, but there has been some missteps. The empathy is that I think she entered a party room that that was already divided. She won just over half the votes, and some of the critics never really came on board. And part of it is, I think she had aspirations of bringing the party to the centre, but there were other people that were never going to countenance that. So she was up against it from the get-go. Having said that, no one could say that she was able to cut through all that effectively against Albanese for most of last year. So that would be a critique. And the second thing is she went hard after Bondi. It was a very politicised response, and demanded that Parliament come back and that they countenance laws to put the hate preachers out of business, Michael. And then, lo and behold, the Prime Minister, being the politician that he is and tactician that he is, brought Parliament back in a hurry at the start of the year, pushed through quickly hate speech laws, and it divided the coalition. So I think she didn't have the ducks in a row in terms of her own team and who would be supportive of such measures before she went out on the attack against the Prime Minister. It's like choosing a fight on a particular term, and then when you get that fight, you can't handle it because the environment doesn't suit you. So what I'm trying to say, she picked that fight, and it backfired really badly on her, and that has been the latest blow in a series of ongoing blows against her leadership. The coalition has blown up. Not so much because of that one issue. I think that the main issue is the rise of One Nation, actually. I think that's why the Nationals are leaving the coalition. But it has been a fatal blow to her leadership, no doubt.
Well, assume, contrary to my previous predictions, that Angus Taylor is the new leader of the Liberal Party. I suppose Susan Lee will just drop out of politics. She wouldn't, after all that, want to be a front bench or even a backbench member of the opposition, would she? But what about the coalition? Littleproud's sort of been around the traps. He's in some ways, on some views, engineered all of this, and he'd be rubbing his hands together with glee, wouldn't he? And Angus Taylor, if he were the guy, he would be welcoming them back in very quickly, surely.
I think that there's two ways this could go. We expect that the new leader, whether it's Taylor or Hastie, and my money's probably on Hastie actually, but they'll push the Liberal Party further to the right to connect with their base more effectively and to stop the dribbling of votes to One Nation. I think they want to shore up their base. They want to make sure that they've got some core issues that they're campaigning on that are solid ground for them. That will help in terms of the One Nation threat. It might also make the Nationals more willing to rejoin them. There's two schools of thought. Either they stay on their own and they can fight One Nation better in their own electorates, or but the problem with that is they don't actually have a coherent policy across the coalition parties if they do that. And that makes campaigning at the next election more tricky, probably. So I guess we'll see. I think with a more conservative Liberal leader, there's better chances for the coalition to reconcile.
Martin, Fremantle Shipping News has always been interested in ports, predominantly the Port of Fremantle, but there are ports everywhere. We occasionally look at the Port Hedland Port, an amazing port. It's usually a long line of ships going straight up to China. And speaking of ports, there's a port in Darwin. And have you been following the comings and goings? A Chinese company has a real interest in it, upset some Australian politicians, and even Albo had things to say. And it looks like China aren't happy with what they've heard.
Yeah, this has been bubbling on a little while, and you'll recall China got themselves a 99-year lease on Darwin Port. It surprised me at the time because, all of our ports are quite important infrastructure, including for national security purposes. But Darwin's right at the very top of Australia, and it's probably in line, it's probably really critical infrastructure when it comes to our northern defences. So it surprised me a bit at the time, given that China's been re prevented and other countries as well from investing in certain parts of our northern infrastructure. Accordingly, there's been a lot of criticism of that deal, and they're being asked to sell it, basically. In fact, the Labor government's policy is for them to sell their 99-year lease and to have it procured. So it's basically a forced sale, Michael. The Chinese ambassador is really unhappy about that. I suspect the Chinese government's really unhappy about this, and they would see that as another example of Sinophobia in Australia, and a lack of trust. And this is coming at a time when probably for the last 4 to 5 years, the Albanese government has cultivated a better relationship with China. So it's really a space to watch, Michael.
Well, we will. Martin, it's been a bit of a flat out week. I've never known what day it is. I think it's Friday. Yesterday I thought it was Wednesday, and then Wednesday I thought it was Thursday. That was all because of the Australia Day, Invasion Day long weekend. But we had this most unfortunate incident in famous Forest Place in Perth. I can remember as a young guy going along and seeing Bob Menzies turning up and talking, and it was always a traditional place for politicians to come when there were big elections on. And on Australia, the 26th, there was an invasion day, particularly Indigenous people turning up to talking about Australian history from an Indigenous point of view. And someone threw an object, I mean, his vision of it, and they've arrested a guy and he's being charged. It obviously was intended to be a bomb. Whether or not he's going to claim it was always intended to be fake and not blow up, or whether he tried to make something incendiary and it didn't work, we'll find out more. But it's pretty damn disturbing, Martin. And we don't expect that sort of thing to be happening in quiet old Perth or Fremantle or Western Australia. How perturbing did you find it?
Very disturbing. This is quite an alarming act, and we're very passionate about everyone having their say, and their voices. And this is an attack on freedom of speech, really, an attack on people's right to express themselves. Look, I can't comment without knowing the circumstances, but on the face value, it looks like a very political act to me, to be throwing what could be a bomb, bomb-like substance or whatever it is that it actually is into an Australia Day, into an Invasion Day march. So there's already discussion around why it hasn't been declared a terrorist act. There's discussion about how much coverage it got compared to Bondi, etc. It is a very serious incident, and it's about, I think we will want to not only ensure that justice is served, but have a look at the circumstances around that and how something like this could occur in Perth. It is without precedent that I can think of. There have been the odd firebombing incident again. I think there's some Jewish sites that have been hit here before, and a couple of neo-Nazis that have been running around before. But this is an attack at a major political rally. So it's a very serious incident.
Once again, I take my hat off to our local police in this regard, because when these sort of events happen, again, it's the lone wolf type thing, isn't it? You see the television news, the person charged in the house is in a quiet, classical, could be on the television series Neighbours suburb, and this guy's fiddling around. People just get motivated to do something. I mean, how do you police it? You don't want the Stasi to take control of our police and security forces in Australia like they did in communist East Germany, but it's a really tough job to do, Martin, if you're in the police or security area.
It is, and look, in a world that where OH&S is more paramount, Michael, I think, you don't want to stop political expression, so you want to find a balance between ensuring safety for everyone, but not stopping these, important protest opportunities, because protest is part of a liberal democracy. Police are in a difficult situation here. They will review all of their policies and processes in the aftermath of this and try and find that balance between allowing protests to continue, but seeing how everyone's safety can be assured as best they can.
Well, as I said at the outset, Martin, a lot has happened since our lovely long weekend here in the West. There's hot temperature, there's bushfires around the country, conflagrations of different sorts, we are hoping don't blow up in the Middle East and elsewhere. But in the meantime, Martin, take it easy.
Thank you, as always, Michael. It's a good time to be talking about these things.
See you next Friday.
Take care.